supervisory accountability, whether or not medical aid was rendered, other issues as whether there were any discrepancies identified and whether or not those discrepancies could be resolved. You also look at other risk factors as to whether or not there are any policy implications there, equipment issues, also training implications. That's all part of one comprehensive package. And again, it's not just to determine whether or not the force was in compliance. It's also to look at what was done well. Were there some things there that can be replicated to make sure that moving forward we continue to do good work and we don't repeat the mistakes of the past? We also need to determine whether or not any training issues identified are something that are to be handled at the individual level or at the organizational level. And what are those feedback loops to make sure that whatever is gleaned from these review boards are reported back in a timely and efficient manner? So all of that to say, these review processes are far more than just one or two areas. It's a lot larger than that, and they're very critical and important. Timeliness is very key. Going back to your point, Mr. Mayor, it's key not just because of the impact that we have on the community with this dangling out there, but it's also hanging over the heads of those involved that took place in the use of force. And again, those also by those impacted by the force as well. I will say that I think I can speak for many chiefs when we are anticipating these reports, one of our largest areas of heartburn, obviously, is what is the report going to say? And I think that it's clear in this incident or this report that the Bureau has made some progress over the years, because the content of the recommendations were not that of flat out we just got it wrong, or there was bias, or there were investigative insufficiencies. The recommendations that were laid out in this report clearly show that there is room for enhancement and improvement to our currently existing internal accountability mechanisms. That we can do. Obviously, at least one of the recommendations have some contractual implications, and I look forward to working with our community stakeholders and our internal stakeholders to sit at the table to make sure that we resolve those. But in the end, we all have the same goal, and we'll make sure that we'll implement these recommendations. Again, I truly appreciate the collaborative process here and the recommendations put forth by that YR group. And this is important in that we are sincerely trying to not only build bridges, but to enhance our transparency and to show that we truly are genuine and that we want to get it right. So I have some of my command staff here with me, Captain Bell. I'll acknowledge as well, and Captain Day from training. And Acting Chief Hendry is here. They were also contributors to some of the responses that we provided to this report as well, and we're all available for answers to any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Commissioner Fish. Thanks, well, Chief.
Thank you, Chief. And I just want to say that last time I saw you was at the Martin Luther King breakfast hosted by the Scanner, and I wanted to come over at the end just to say hello, but there was a line out the door of people wanting to take their picture with you. So I thought that was a pretty healthy sign of how the community was responding to your leadership. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the response that you submitted to the recommendations. And having worked, for example, with a prior council and now with this mayor on the 48-hour rule, and knowing that sometimes there's significant challenges between us deciding we want to take an action and actually affecting that action. I look at some of these comments and I'm thinking, okay, where are going to be the most substantial barriers to moving? And at the front end, I want to say that in reviewing your letter, one of the things that I applaud is that in almost every instance where you agree with a recommendation and you pledge to make a change, you have a timeline for that action. So that will allow us to monitor the progress and hopefully get some further report. So I applaud you for that. But let's look at recommendation 22. Mayor talked about this a little bit. This has gotten some attention. And this, of course, is the one about whether an officer can view video evidence prior to submitting a statement. You agree with the recommendation, but I just want to quote what you say. This issue may be subject to collective bargaining. Now, that's a may. And so having been involved in these kinds of conversations before, and based on my background as a labor lawyer, I get it that there's a gray area here. I guess my question is, when do you expect to have a clear understanding of whether it is or it isn't? And then depending on what the law is, because after all, we must follow the law based on the best guidance we receive, what is your intended plan of action to tackle this problem?
That's a fair question, and thank you for asking that. So I will say that dialogue has already begun. I did receive a letter from the PPA regarding some concerns, specifically as it relates to number 22, and I believe you might have all received a copy of that letter as well. My first priority is to make sure that I educate everyone as to why I agree with this. There are some very fair concerns and fears and anxieties out there relating to why an officer, especially for an officer-involved shooting, believes they should be allowed to view the footage prior to providing a statement. And my message has been very clear. I also shared the same message with the command staff and have asked that this be relayed throughout the organization. When you look at it in its totality, it's really to the advantage of the officer. And here's why. The standard for whether or not a use of force is in compliance is the reasonableness standard. It's the Graham standard. That doesn't change whether or not there is footage available, surveillance footage, body-worn camera footage, or no footage at all. The standard is the standard. It's not whether something was right or wrong. It's whether or not it was objectively reasonable. And with that said, there may be discrepancies with or without footage. It could be, as science shows, that an officer's recall is more enlightened or enhanced as several months progress. Obviously, we're not giving statements that far down the road, but they might remember some things later on. So things may or may not add up. But there's a reticence amongst officers, and I understand why, that if they're given statements with discrepancies or inconsistencies, that at some point, someone somewhere might say, you're being untruthful because you didn't say it right the first time. And what I'm saying is, if we allow officers to view footage prior to providing a statement, it doesn't fully allow you the opportunity to recall the way you felt it and you saw it and you perceived it at the time you made the decision to shoot. So the first priority is education. I've already started the dialogue and making sure that we're setting up some time to sit across the table to get this hashed out, if this is something that needs to be negotiated or not. The other piece is that along with the mayor's office, we've already begun traveling as it relates to body-worn cameras and programs to visit other major cities that have already implemented the body-worn camera program, and we've looked at their policies. And there are agencies throughout the country that do not allow officers to view footage prior to providing a statement for an officer-involved shooting, I will say. Not for all uses of force, but for an officer-involved shooting. So the research has already been done.
Okay.
And so we're doing everything that we can to make our position as strong as it can be, but to make sure that the advantages are relayed and to make sure that it's messaged that this is not an aha gotcha. No one is trying to get an officer in trouble or to set anyone up for failure.
Well, I appreciate that response, and I guess underlying this is a question of trust.
Absolutely.
And whether we have shared goals or not. You know, for 20-odd years before I had the honor of doing this job, I was a lawyer, and I spent a lot of time preparing witnesses for testimony. One of the things that I tried to communicate to nervous witnesses was minor discrepancies in testimony actually humanizes the testimony. The person who gets up and gives robotic testimony that's been carefully sculpted, everything, that instinctively rings false because no human being remembers every single detail. And the more you present like that, the more obvious it is to anybody listening to you that you've been carefully rehearsed and everything is done. The minor discrepancies are part of what connects us to other human beings. I got some details wrong. I guess the question that we're going to have to grapple with is sort of the difference between a minor and a major discrepancy.
Yes.
And, you know, frankly, as I get a little older, I find my minor discrepancies are becoming more regular in just how I recall things and sometimes memory issues. But that I'm less concerned about someone that says there were six people there, not seven, confuses a name, you know, has some detail wrong, because that's human. And I think as you pointed out, at that moment where there's a lot of trauma at the site, there's a lot of activity, sometimes the memory is not always operating at the highest level. So I think the question really has to be some trust here. Minor discrepancies that get cleaned up, it seems to me that makes a lot of sense. I guess there's a point at which it becomes a major discrepancy, and then it raises a larger issue about, is the person being fully forthcoming and truthful? But I like the way you framed it, because the goal here is to get, and I like the way you, in fact, went one step further and said there, that the officer has, there's an advantage to the officer in adhering to the guideline that you want to put in place. The question of whether it has to be bargained or not becomes a question that we can opine on, but ultimately an administrative law judge or a court will have the final say. And then I think people should understand that in plain English, which that means is it slows down the process if someone says it's a mandatory subject to bargaining. But I'd like to know at your earliest convenience what your best legal, privately, I'd like to know what your best legal sense is on that question. So thank you.
You're welcome.
I just had a question regarding less lethal shotguns. And one of the cases that were profiled here by OIR had a situation where they had to call in a less lethal shotgun. And I'm just curious what the current state of training and deployment is with regard to less lethal shotguns.
I'm prepared to answer that, but I'll have our subject matter expert come up.
Sure, that's great.
And assist with that.
Mm-hmm. Great. And I just want to remind people, some of these cases are quite old, and in many cases I've noted, and you noted in your letter, that we've already changed policies in some cases and changed training in some cases, and this may well be one. Greetings.
Yeah,
thank you.
Good afternoon, Mayor, Commissioners. Thank you. I'm Bob Day. I'm the captain assigned to the training division. So for several years, the Police Bureau has used a tool referred to as the less lethal shotgun or the beanbag, which is a shotgun firing system that shoots out essentially small beanbags in an attempt to, you know, distract or stop the threat. We've begun a robust review of that over the last year or two for a variety of reasons, and came to the conclusion to change the system entirely as a tool. So we now have just completed a transition to a 40-millimeter less lethal weapon system. It's a single shot, so it shoots essentially a rubber baton, for lack of a better term, a projectile that will, you know, have the same desired effect, but it's more accurate and extends some of the distance so that we can create more space and more time, which is what we're always looking for in these situations. We've begun that process last fall, and we currently have about 130-some-odd operators certified in that. Prior to, we had about 150 total less lethal shotgun operators. Stand by, because we're going to be having some additional training and bringing on about another 45 to 48 operators this spring as we put them through certification courses. So, you know, at the result of this, at the end of this conversation from this report, for that recommendation, we'll no longer have less lethal shotguns even on the street or in the system at all, probably within the next 60 to 90 days would be my guess, maybe sooner. My goal is to try and get them all distributed by the end of March. We're also going to have four additional classes of about 48 officers each. So we'll bring our numbers up to nearly 180 operators on the street, where, as I said previously, we had 150. So we're expanding the capacity. I believe it's a more appropriate tool, better use for the officers, as well as, you know, when need be for the community, because it gives us a greater sense of accuracy and control. So That recommendation is essentially fulfilled or will be hopefully by the end of March.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I had a question, Chief, and again, this may be one that we have to put to somebody else, and it's regarding attorneys who accompany their clients on a walkthrough and offer what OIR refers to as evidence to the investigators. And the concern here, of course, is that the attorneys are not eyewitnesses. I guess there could be a rare situation where they are, but generally they are not eyewitnesses to the account. And there they are presenting evidence to investigators. And I understand that you agree with their recommendation that they should not be able to offer evidence. I just want to clarify, though, I believe the officers have a right to an attorney being present during the walkthrough. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I had that correct. Thank you. Good. Those are my questions. All right. Good. Thank you, Chief. We appreciate it very much. I don't know if OIR, if you want to come back up, if there's anything you want to say for the good of the room.
We look forward to seeing you in August.
Very good.
We will have another 9 cases.
Good. Well, I want to thank you very much for your good work, and we spoke informally. I spoke informally with the folks from OIR. I'd like to see us get to the point where we can actually catch up to the current and have review of current cases and get caught up on that. I want to acknowledge a couple of things that have already been acknowledged here in closing. First of all, being a police officer is a very difficult job. It's hard work. It requires a high degree of professionalism. I am proud to serve as the police commissioner, and I want to be very clear about that. I always believe that we can do better. And so I just want people to understand, as I ask questions of the Bureau that I am responsible for as the commissioner in charge, I want to be clear, it's because I have high hopes as well as high expectations of that Bureau. And I know I share that with Chief Outlaw. And so I want to thank the folks from the OIR group for being unvarnished and focused in their evaluation. Director Sevier, I want to thank you, and IPR for the great work you do. Madam Auditor, thank you. This is really your whole show today. And I want to thank you for a process that is highly public and transparent. This report is available. Anybody can take a look at it. Again, we are happy to take written comments. If people disagree with anything they heard today or have a different view, we'd certainly be open to hearing that perspective. So thank you all for being here today, and we'll see you next time. We're adjourned.
Hey, Debbie.